stunned silence.
Oh, yes.
A bit of an episode,
right? So it must be doing something, right?
And it's playing its playing or something.
Tell us what you're doing.
I just can't figure it out.
I love the enthusiasm.
Really?
You're tuned to 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 114 for March 15, 2017. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we've got Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. You've got through the numbers there again, as always. No, it's tricky, isn't it?
It is tricky, and I wasn't actually that good at maths either, as long as I don't have to add them up. And we're very, very lucky to welcome Anna to the podcast. Anna, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, James. It's great to be here.
It's fantastic to have you, bringing some class to this podcast. Not saying Don, who will be listening, but unfortunately can't join us this week, that he'll be sitting there going, well, are you saying I don't bring any class? No, of course you do, Don. It's a different kind of class, though. I think that would be fair. How is everything going in your guys' worlds? How's things over there in Australia, Gavin?
Actually, we're going through a series of storms at the moment, so yes. I don't know if this is normal. I haven't lived here long enough to figure out if this is what happens in March or not, but we've had great weather and it's just turning to custard, as we say in this part of the world. I don't know if that's an international saying, but the weather's getting poor at the moment and it's not good.
Well, I'm not happy about it. Anna, you're, for our listeners who obviously this is the first time they're meeting you, you're in Auckland as well?
Yes, I am, yep.
So we've had some rain of biblical proportions over the last
few
days.
We have.
I had a little chuckle to myself when, I was staring out the window and it was, visibility would have been, 4 or 5 meters. There was so much rain coming down. For our listeners overseas, we got about a month's worth of rain in the course of a day. And it was pretty intense. And I was staring out there and my phone beeped with an alert from the New Zealand Herald saying, water shortage in Auckland.
And I
was staring out there. What it actually meant to say was clean water shortage in Auckland, because so much water is causing floods and then slips into the drinking supply. So it's been a bit rough for March. I mean, March is usually when all the, settled weather is, but not so much at the moment.
Well, I'm hoping it's going to be all right in April.
Bring it in. Bring it on. Yes.
I'm coming to visit.
You are coming to visit. Coming to visit. We might have to try and do a recording in person-ish around then.
Yeah, just about that.
Yeah. Well, we'd just be open to the possibility of it, Gavin.
I'm open to all possibilities.
Well, so is the Pope when it comes to the possibility of ordaining married men. This is our first story from the Associated Press. Pope, see that seamless segue, Anna? That's how I roll.
That was very good.
Pope Francis says the Church must study whether it's possible to ordain married men to minister in remote communities facing priest shortages. In an interview published last week in Germany's Die Zeit, Francis stressed that removing the celibacy rule is not the answer to the Catholic Church's priest shortage, but he expressed an openness to studying whether so-called viri probati, or married men of proven faith, could be ordained. We must consider if viri probati is a possibility. Then we must determine what tasks they can perform, for example, in remote communities, he was quoted as saying. The viri probati, which is probably not how you say it, I'm guessing it's Latin. Proposal has been around for decades, but it has drawn fresh attention under history's first Latin American pope, thanks in part to his appreciation of the challenges facing the church in places like Brazil, a huge Catholic country with an acute shortage of priests, according to the Associated Press. Brazilian Cardinal Claudio Gomes, it's probably not how you pronounce his name, but that's okay, a longtime friend of Francis and former head of the Vatican's Office for Clergy, is reportedly pressing to allow viri probati in the Amazon, where the church counts around one priest for every 10,000 Catholics. Francis has shown particular openness to receiving concrete proposals for ordaining married men, as well as his own pastoral concern for men who have left ministry to marry. He has also said that while he favours a celibate priesthood, celibacy technically can be up for discussion since it's a discipline of the church, not a dogma. The church allows some exceptions to the rule. Priests in the Eastern Rite Catholic Church are allowed to be married, as are married Anglican priests who convert to Catholicism. Well, this is pretty interesting, Gavin. What did you make of this? I mean, this sort of came out of nowhere. I hadn't sort of heard that the Pope was even being asked to weigh in on this topic. What did you make of this news?
Well, I suspect he's asked about it quite regularly, along with some of the other great debates that are being had around some of the roles of people who are currently, with those exceptions noted that you just explained there, that currently married men, for the most part, and women completely are excluded from certain types of ministry. And so he's probably hearing these sorts of drum beats for a while. It reminded me that back in, I think it was 2005, there was a synod in Rome, and I think it was Bishop Dennis Brown. I don't know, Anna, if you remember. I think it was Bishop Dennis who raised this idea of viri probati. He may have been sort of representing Oceania at the synod and was speaking about this concept, particularly for maybe not the Pacific Islands so much in terms of Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, that part, but maybe places like Papua New Guinea and some of those places where there is a not as great a number of Catholics as somewhere like Brazil, but where this remoteness is a challenge. And I think he was expressing the sense that, you know, that people who live in certain remote parts of certain countries where there aren't enough priests are essentially excluded from the sacraments because of the lack of priests available. So as the story suggested, it has been an issue that's been brewing for a while. Sometimes it's this discussion of married priests is framed in this sense of how do we deal with the shortage in large countries that have lots of remote areas. And sometimes that morphs into a broader discussion around married priests more generally in terms of, you know, in Sydney or in Auckland, do we have a priest shortage that requires married men? I would argue not, but sometimes the two issues are sort of blended together to become a broader issue about the married priesthood, not just this issue of how we try and support communities that are struggling to provide access to the sacraments.
It's something, Anna, I mean, I don't know if you find this talking with friends who aren't Catholics. It's something that I find that with some of my friends is quite misunderstood. They equate sort of married priesthood to women as priests as being the same thing. Why can't the church just sort of just, you know, open up all the laws on all of those things? But they are quite different. Do you find that that's confusing for Catholic or non-Catholic friends?
I don't know. I probably haven't seen the come across those two things being sort of put together. If you can have one, maybe right. Why can't you have the other? But yeah, I mean, perhaps just overall, people maybe outside the church might view the priesthood in a way that's far more, or they might view the way that we look at it as quite narrow. You know, only men and unmarried men as a general rule. So, yeah, perhaps it all comes under sort of a very narrow look on priesthood that people outside the church would possibly like us to widen, maybe.
So did you, I mean, when you saw this news, did you have any thoughts about whether the Pope should be looking at this or whether it's something that that should be on the agenda?
Well, I think yes. I mean, if people in the church have brought it up, then surely it's something that the Pope should look at. And I don't see there's a problem, if there is a problem with looking at it. Perhaps it needs to be wider in the sense of looking at how to deal just with countries that are really struggling for enough priests. And maybe not just look at whether the married priesthood is the answer, but maybe there's other things too that should be considered, maybe first of all before married priesthood, because maybe, yeah, you start a bit of a slippery slope if you allow that in certain places. I guess that's happened before in the church, yeah. So we're... You know, that would be, I'd be a bit reticent about that. And looking at and considering it doesn't necessarily mean that the answer is going to be let's have a married priesthood in certain areas. In fact, it might actually come up that that's not the answer.
It's a good point.
So, yeah just... I mean, how many more men are actually going to become priests if they can be married in the Amazon somewhere? Yeah. You know, you probably... I don't know, maybe there's a reason why there is a reason why it's difficult to get priests out there. So,
well, I mean, that's a really good point. And I mean, Gavin, we have talked about married priests on the podcast before, but I think, I mean, I remember talking at the time, this would be a few years ago now, but there was some talk at the time of some return, it was Anglicans returning, converting to the faith and being married priests themselves, and both their and that being recognized by the church. But there being some council or a committee that had, I think, sought advice on this from the Eastern Rite Catholic tradition, and also from the Anglicans. And actually, the commentary at the time I seem to recall was saying, "Look, if you can, you know, if you can avoid it, avoid it." Mainly because the choosing between, you know, it's very hard for, oh, as a married man myself, it's very difficult to imagine being able to be totally dedicated to the church and totally dedicated to my wife at the same time, and those roles being in conflict at points. You know, I think we talked about what happens if, you know, obviously if the priest is married and has children, you know, at what point does he, you know, he's got to go out and visit someone who's needing last rites at 3 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the afternoon at his daughter's, you know, fifth birthday party. I mean, how do you sort of weigh those things up? I seem to remember us having those discussions, or did I just imagine them?
I know there would have been some of those discussions, and then one of the responses that I hear, and I'm not denying the reality that you've just presented in the hypothetical case of you being a priest, which would make many people happy. But you know, that doctors and people in other ministries are also people who are torn in different directions and manage it fine. So it is an interesting discussion. I've actually, if I can indulge the panel for a moment, before I sort of put this on the show for this month, I saw a commentary from a person who, one of these faux friends on Facebook. Now, he's a real person, but he's not someone I've had the pleasure of meeting, but someone who actually, through this work, who I've come to know remotely through some of our friends in the US and that sort of thing. And he's just written a brief reflection, which I might just read if that's okay. Sure. Which really gets to an interesting point. And I think Anna was sort of, she may not have seen this, but she was sort of getting to this point around, you know, looking at the broader issues that the church has to deal with around this concept of a priestly shortage. So this is from Marcel Lejeune, who used to work in campus ministry at a university in Texas. So he asks, why is there a priest shortage? And he says, because there's a disciple shortage. And why is there a disciple shortage? Because there is a lack of evangelization. And why is there a lack of evangelization? Because there is a lack of understanding of our identity. And why is there a lack of understanding of our Christian identity? Because we relied on a Catholic culture for too long to do the work of evangelization and discipleship for us. Thus, the answer to our problems in the church today is to go back to discipleship and evangelization. This will not only fix the priest shortage, it will fix nearly every problem in the church. End quote. Mm.
The culture, that we've relied on the culture for too long as opposed to discipleship.
Yeah, so this, I think the sense in which, you know, that Catholicism was just handed down and people were immersed in sort of Catholicity, right. Yeah. Through their family or through their community or through their parish, and that there wasn't enough energy put into, this is my reading of it, Marcel doesn't necessarily expand on it in this way, but there wasn't a sense of we need to talk about evangelization and discipleship, because people, just being Catholic was who they were, it was part of their being and not part of their consciousness, if that makes sense. It was just sort of something subconscious that they were part of, and therefore the church or the members of the church had forgotten what the mission of the church in terms of spreading the gospel, evangelizing and being disciples. So that's my interpretation of what those words mean. Mm. Now that may not be his own interpretation of his own words. I'll leave you to ask
No, what I was going to say is, I think that it is something which it isn't a discussion or a debate that's going to go away. I think it is something which will continue to stay around. I think, to your point, Anna, it's looking at what are the actual root causes of the shortage, and you know that reflection, Gavin, has some concepts in it. And when we're talking about specifically areas that the article is referring to, like parts of Brazil, you know, you are left saying, well, maybe if the last barrier is one, you know, if there'd be men filling the seminaries, if only it was that they were allowed to marry or stay married, then I could see that being applied. But I'm not sure how many. I mean, I do know some, to be fair. I mean, I've got a number of friends who, you know, went into the seminary for a number of years and then felt the call, the stronger call for them was a call towards the vocation of marriage. So if they hadn't had to choose between the two, would they have stayed and become priests? I know there are plenty of married men who could make amazing priests on many levels. So it's complicated. It's complicated. But as long as the Pope's considering it, talking about it, we'll talk about it here on this podcast. Speaking of the Pope, our second story from America Magazine. In an interview given to a magazine run by the homeless and socially excluded in Italy, Pope Francis said Catholics should offer housing or financial assistance to families settling in a new country. Here in the Vatican, there are two parishes, and both are housing Syrian families. Many parishes in Rome have also opened their doors, and others, which don't have a house for priests, have offered to pay rent for families in need for a full year, he said. Some critics of the Pope have derided his stance on refugees, claiming that the Vatican is a walled city, or that he only talks about helping migrants instead of directly assisting them. The interview was published on the eve of Ash Wednesday, the start of the Lenten season of penance and almsgiving. Francis said giving to the needy must be a priority and challenged those who make excuses against giving money to people on the streets. People who worry about how the money might be spent should ask themselves what guilty pleasures they are secretly spending money on, the Pope said. There are many excuses to justify why one does not lend a hand when asked by a person begging on the street, he said. Some may think, I give money and he just spends it on a glass of wine, Francis said. But he joked, a glass of wine is his only happiness in life. Giving something to someone in need is always right, the Pope said, adding that it should be done with respect and compassion because tossing money and not looking in their eyes is not a Christian way of behaving. Quote, in the shoes of the other, we learn to have a great capacity for understanding, for getting to know difficult situations, end quote. People during this interview with the magazine, whose title means sneakers in English, Francis talked about the importance of being able to walk in other people's shoes. He also spoke about the importance of ensuring that new arrivals are given opportunities to integrate into the culture. Well, that's some pretty confronting words there from the Pope, Anna, saying that, you know, you shouldn't rationalize to yourself if you're walking on the street and someone's begging that, oh, he's just going to spend it on alcohol or he's just going to go on to something less, something not good. He's still saying, well, that's not a good enough reason to not give.
Yeah, it's a hard one, actually, isn't it? I in some of my time overseas, come across beggars, and particularly in Italy, where obviously the Pope is, and hearing stories that half the beggars are working for the mafia or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, then you're like, well, who, like, if I give money to them, what, where is that money going? And is it actually helping those people, or is it actually just keeping them in some kind of slavery, which is what they're doing? But I always remember someone saying to me, if you're worried about giving money and someone's asking for money for food, well, why don't you actually take them and buy food for them and give them something that that they need, and maybe even spend some time with them, and, you know, so you sort of, I don't know, connect with them on a human level, but then also give them something that they might need, and that at least you know that your money has gone on some food or whatever. But he is kind of right. I think he has a point. Like, we can't just give and then sort of stipulate how they spend that money.
Yep, it's a good point. Gavin, what did you make of what the Pope's guidance here in terms of charity and walking in another person's shoes?
Well, what I would say is that I haven't followed it particularly well during the course of my life.
This isn't confession, Gavin. I've told you that before.
Oh, yeah, sorry. We're supposed to go before Easter, though, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah, this doesn't count, okay. Yeah, so it's there are occasions where I've sort of used that concept of seeing someone who's asking for money for food and actually have bought them food and money to present them. Most times I walk past and either put a small amount of money in or don't put anything in, would be the way I would normally approach it. But there have been occasions when I do approach it in that way of, you know, here's you know, what, there are some outside the McDonald's down near the harbour in Sydney, for example, and sometimes I might go and grab them a hamburger or something. One night I spent a few minutes talking to a guy whose story was, at least, that he was down and out and been kicked out of his place. So I went and bought him a toothbrush and some deodorant and some stuff. But as I say, normally I don't engage in that way. There was an interesting story in Australia a few months ago when the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, was walking past a group of beggars in Melbourne, and he gave a gentleman $5 and spoke with him for a little while, and the cameras were there, and, you know, some people say, oh, we only did it because the cameras were there, and other people criticised him because he gave him money at all, because some people said he shouldn't be giving money to beggars. And then other people said, he's a multimillionaire, why did he only give him $5? How cheap is he? So it's a anyone's decision on this is fraught, I guess, in some ways. But I think that sense in which, if you're putting money into whatever they're accepting money in, their bowl or their bucket or whatever, that idea of looking them in the eye that Pope Francis refers to, I think, is an important one. Actually, even just for a few seconds, connecting with the person on the human level, to me, and all of the stuff that he said there, which is all worthy, to me, that's the thing that's stuck with me when I read it for the first time a couple of days ago, was that sense of looking into their eyes as a way of having a Christian response. If you can give them money, then that's fine. And if you can't, but just in terms of treating them as a human, because so many days they probably go through the day and don't have that level of interaction with anybody.
Yeah, it is.
So if we can at least offer them that.
I think it's a really, really important point and an aspect of it that I hadn't really reflected on as much as I do after, you know, having read the article. And I guess that's what the Pope is trying to do here, is to sort of not just prick the conscience of the faithful, but actually challenge us. And, you know, I guess the angle I've usually taken has been because of the too many variables, right, the too many unknowns. There's been a couple of situations where, I've been overseas and traveling and maybe for work or for business, and we've come away from the restaurant and there's been all this food and it just feels wasteful for it to go away. So a couple of times when I've sort of tried to take, you know, some of the leftovers and go give them to, you know, usually in most of the big cities, in the central city, you'll often find people who are down on their luck and are begging. But, you know, I've also had situations where I've done that and there's been no one who wants to take the food, maybe because it's a suspicious parcel, I don't know, or because of the suspicious character giving it to them. And I think where I've tried to tend more to go is to try and support agencies that support these people, and whether that's anything from, you know, Caritas and the programs they have, to Salvation Army, to the city missions.
City mission, yeah.
And we do, and it's not always, doesn't always have to be money, you know. In particular, things like some of the shops around here, some of the places around here that are, you can donate clothes to, and they can either sell the clothes and then give the money, or they can actually help the clothes for those who are down and out or trying to get themselves back up, and it's hard to, you know, go to a job interview when you don't actually have a decent shirt and trousers. But I do think that the comment of it is easier sometimes to rationale away or explain away, particularly when you're in cities like San Francisco, which have a very pronounced begging problem. You know, it's kind of known as part of their culture, so much so that other cities, apparently, and I've heard this from multiple sources, it's not just something I read on the internet, but have had programs where they've actually encouraged and rounded up people who are begging on their streets and then paid for them to have a one-way ticket if they wanted to take it to San Francisco, because I think San Fran is the one city that doesn't have panhandling laws, one of the major cities in the states. Could have that wrong, and
there are lots of laws they don't have in San Francisco.
It's true. Some of our listeners might want to correct me, but I do think it's a good challenge. It's a good challenge, and actually, you know, as he says there, giving something to someone in need is always right. And I guess we can sometimes try and justify whether or not the person actually is in need or not. But why not err on the side of charity, is I think what the Pope's challenge is. A good message for Lent. I'm sure our Cardinal would agree. This is our next article from the NZ Catholic. Cardinal John Dew has decreed the convocation of a synod for the Archdiocese of Wellington to be held in September this year. The last synod in the Archdiocese was in 2006. This synod will be the fifth for the Archdiocese. In his letter convoking the synod, Cardinal Dew wrote that he is mindful of Pope Francis's desire that we advance along the path of what he calls, quote, pastoral and missionary conversion, which cannot leave things as they presently are. The Cardinal added, it means being bold and creative in the task of rethinking the goals, structures, styles, and methods of evangelization in our diocesan community, with its various parishes, with its various parish and ecclesial, religious, and social communities. In a statement on the Archdiocese's website, Cardinal Dew wrote that Pope Francis is, quote, reshaping our priorities and attitudes, and we need to respond at grassroots level to his vision. The Cardinal highlighted certain themes that Pope Francis returns to again and again, such as the peripheries of society, refugees and migrants, care for creation, ecumenism, interfaith relations, and accompanying the young. Such themes, and others like leadership, ethnic diversity, prayer and discernment, need to be put before the people for their consideration, the Cardinal added. This is to widen people's thinking beyond what they currently experience in their parish. Quote, the 2017 Synod is a unique and timely opportunity for us to reflect on how we can be a church that is of service to the world around us. End quote. It's a good theme there, Gavin, to get a synod together and talk about how you can reach out and be a church of service to the world around us. What do you make of all those different pieces of the puzzle that he's talking about there? Rethinking goals, structures, styles, methods of evangelization.
Yes, it's an interesting way to go about it, isn't it? They're trying to convoke a national synod, or I don't think it'd be called a synod. I think it's going to be called a plenary council. In Australia, and I suspect some of the similar themes will come up there. And Pope Francis is certainly, in many ways, making us think a little bit differently about the way the church approaches the world, and probably vice versa for that matter. But what I would caution against is that this turns into, and this is not just the synod, but many things that sometimes happen within the church is we end up having a bit of a talk fest. And sometimes things don't necessarily change, and or some things are mooted to change, which maybe aren't really topics that should be up for changing. So it's a delicate process. But I think, you know, any way in which one of the problems they've got in Australia is because, as I understand it, and again, listeners might correct me, as they did Mike for James on San Francisco, that in Australia, the plenary council will be constituted in such a way that I think priests and religious end up being about 70% of the participants.
Oh.
Yeah, I was told that because of the it's a canonical requirement or something that that a plenary council is constituted that way. So to me, that turns things upside down. I don't know if a synod has different requirements, but I think there's certainly a need for lay people to have a significant input into it, if you have a synod or plenary council, whatever it is, just to ensure that it is indeed hearing the concerns of the people and responding to them, rather than necessarily an echo chamber of the sort of, you know, the in crowd, whether that's priests and religious or people who work in diocesan offices, as I have before.
You were part of the in crowd, and you're not a part of the in crowd now.
Woe is me. So I think having a gathering to discuss some of the big issues facing the church is a great thing, but let's make sure that they're the right things, and that they do lead to outcomes that do actually achieve some of the things that are outlined.
Anna, what did you make of His Eminence's call for a synod? I mean, there's a lot of stuff on that agenda, and I guess to Gavin's point, It could just turn into a talk fest. But then again, maybe it could affect some needed change. What do you think?
Well, am I right in saying that it's only like a 3-day synod?
I think that's correct, yeah. Actually, the date had to be changed. It's not in the story, but the date was set, and then the Catholic Prime Minister didn't check with the Catholic Archbishop of Wellington on the election date. So the election ended up being set on the weekend on which the synod had been scheduled. So the synod has since been moved. That's a fun fact. Fun fact.
There you go.
But you're right, it was just a weekend.
A 3-day, yeah, a long weekend.
Yeah, I kind of, look, I do get a little bit cynical about these things because so often we just talk about goals and things like that, and they just never produce fruit, like as in disciples. Like I was kind of thinking, Gavin, of what you read before, like that's actually something that we need to face up to, I think, that we need more evangelization and we need to develop our discipleship first and foremost, learn to be faithful practicing Catholics, and then, you know, and then we can maybe think about other things like goals and structures and things like that. It's kind of building a house on sand, isn't it? Like, it's just kind of what it feels like to me, but that's maybe me being a little bit cynical. But I do, I mean, certainly looking at style and methods of evangelization is something I think that is, I hope, gets a lot of space at the synod, and also I did like what the cardinal, like what he was saying about, you know, trying to broaden people's experience of the church just from you know outside their parish, that they're actually sort of part of something bigger. They're part of an archdiocese. They're part of a universal church. Like I think that is a good thing to do as well. So yeah, I mean, I hope it's a fruitful venture. And my cynical self says I've kind of heard it all before and doesn't often produce.
And you're keen to be proven wrong. So if
that would be nice.
If the cardinal's listening, there you go. A challenge from Anna: prove her wrong. But I do think that. If His Eminence is listening, I would suggest that there's quite a lot of things on that agenda for 3 days. I genuinely wish them all the best and pray that the time that they spend together is fruitful and only benefits the church in New Zealand. And you know, it's tricky stuff. You know,
they should get you to go and talk, James.
I don't know if that would add much value. I think they would probably impose a travel ban. This is our next story from the Catholic News Service. American Catholic bishops have expressed concern at Gavin's suggestion that I speak at the synod. No, following the introduction of a revised travel ban, following President Donald Trump's latest executive order banning arrivals from 6 majority Muslim nations, Bishop Joe S. Vasquez, let's go with that, of Austin, Texas, chairman of the U.S. Bishops Committee on Migration, said Trump's new order still puts vulnerable populations at risk. "We remain deeply troubled by the human consequences of the order," he said in a statement. "While we note that the administration's efforts to modify the executive order in light of various legal concerns, the revised order still leaves many innocent lives at risk." He said that Catholic bishops welcomed Iraq being removed from the list of countries. Yes, yeah, I said it the American way, Iraq. But remain disappointed the order still temporarily shuts down the refugee admissions program, reduces by more than 60% the number of refugees who can enter the country, and still bars nationals from 6 countries. The bishops, quote, "have long recognized the importance of ensuring public safety and would welcome reasonable and necessary steps to accomplish that goal," Bishop Vasquez said. "However, based on the knowledge that refugees are already subjected to the most vigorous vetting process of anyone who enters the United States, there is no merit to pausing the refugee resettlement program while considering further improvement to that vetting process," end quote. Bill O'Keefe, Vice President for Advocacy and Government Relations at Catholic Relief Services, said in a statement, "As the world's most blessed nation, we should be doing more to provide assistance overseas and resettle the most vulnerable not less. It is wrong during this time of great need to cut humanitarian assistance and reduce resettlement. O'Keefe added, refugees are fleeing the same terrorism that we seek to protect ourselves from. By welcoming them, we show the world that we are an open, tolerant nation which seeks to protect the vulnerable. That has always been America's greatest strength. Well, we've had a little bit of discussion of this on the podcast, and Don, if he was here, I'm sure would weigh in. So, Anna, you're going to have to try and do your best Don impersonation. No, that's okay. We'll settle for Anna. That's more than enough. What do you make of this? So here's President Trump having another go at trying to do an executive order, preferably one that won't get thrown out by his own courts this time. But the bishops are going, still, it's tackling the wrong stuff. What did you make of this?
Well, I guess if to be fair, I haven't really looked at exactly what he's trying to do, except for just sort of what's generally, you know, reported. And I guess I'm in two minds because I do understand the necessity, and maybe for the states, it's a completely different experience to what we have here in New Zealand, but, you know, to be really careful about who they let in. But yeah, at the same time, I'd say the majority of the people who are trying to get into the states are genuinely seeking, you know, a better home and will be good citizens and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, it seems like a bit of a mess, particularly because he's not getting much support for it. So
That's a pretty good summary from where I sit. It seems like a bit of a mess, Gavin. You follow politics historically way closer than I do, but it does seem like a bit of a mess. And I think what the bishops are probably responding to here is, you know, we have a phrase in the corporate world. What's the problem you're actually trying to solve here? Because I'm not convinced that the travel ban, even in its so-called refined state, is going to do what the president is after. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting because you said historically I follow this stuff more closely than you do. Another part of my Lenten confession, I might say that I find it very hard to very difficult to follow U.S. politics at this point in my existence, given all of the madness that's going on over there. But that's a bit of a digression from your original question. So because this is this ongoing sense of despair, I guess, that I get around many of the things that are being implemented or trying to be implemented in the US, and I find much about this particular area around the travel ban or whatever we want to call it more euphemistically, but let's call it the travel ban for ease of comprehension. I mean, the point that Bill O'Keefe from Catholic Relief Services came up with, you know, these people are fleeing exactly the sort of terrible circumstances that are trying to be the US is trying to protect itself from, or that President Trump and his people are trying to protect it from. These aren't people who are sort of run-of-the-mill people who might have been radicalized and they want to come to the US and cause trouble. That's what the extreme vetting, as it's known, is. And that's what the extreme vetting process is designed to ensure, that people don't come in who have these tendencies. And I think Don said two or three episodes ago, humanity and compassion and a sense of the dignity of every person means that if you're going to let in 10,000 people and one of them might be a an undesirable, if you want to use that term, someone who might cause trouble, don't leave the 999 other people out in the cold for the sake of one possible bad egg. And amongst that, because the process, vetting process is quite severe. In Australia, there was an agreement that I think 1,500 people who have been held in detention camps on the island of Nauru and on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea were to be sent to the US, and they were going to be vetted under this extreme vetting clause to try and ensure the safety of borders. That seems like a sufficient check and balance in place. that the travel ban is excessive and why it's considered unacceptable by so many people.
It's something which I guess, you know, it's easy to say, oh, the terrorists have already won, in terms of the sense of fear that has been instilled in the Western world. But the part that sort of really resonated to me from this story was where Bill O'Keefe said there at the end there about they're fleeing the same terrorism, right, which we seek to protect ourselves from, rather than that they are just the source of all terrorism. You know, there was some there was some articles flying around the internet on the when the first version of the travel ban kicked in, pointing out that actually all the you know, the acts of terrorism that have been committed on US soil were either disproportionately, well, I think the point was that none of the countries that were banned actually had nationals who were involved in the attacks that we're all aware of, and that a large number of them have been caused by Americans, you know, born and bred in America. So, you know, there isn't, I think there is no, it's like hate doesn't stop at the border and isn't stop, it's not something you declare on your passenger arrival card. But, and I do think that the challenge when you have got so much, which the States does in many cases, so many resources, you know, as does Australia, as does New Zealand. I mean, it's hard for me to sit here in New Zealand with our relatively paltry contribution to refugee resettlement and kind of, you know, let he is who was without sin cast the first stone and everything. But I don't know. I just don't know if this ban is doing the right thing. Not that they listen to me when they're writing their policies.
Well, Pope Francis would probably suggest it wasn't, based on his sense about, you know, supporting those who are coming from other countries. Yeah. And his actual assistance for, you know, the Syrian, Syrian families at the Vatican, and when he went to was it to Turkey, or to Greece, was it? He brought back a family from there back to Rome with him. So, yeah, it's, you know, it is in many ways the politics of, you know, creating an us and them scenario, which again Bill O'Keefe at the end says that's not the American way. Now, I lived over there for many years, as many people, listeners, know. So I've heard a lot about, you know, what is and what isn't the American way. But I think there is a sense in which, you know, much of the American fabric has been around helping those who are in need. Sometimes doubt than other times.
Indeed. Well, again, lots of challenging. There's lots of challenging on the podcast today. So let's see if we can end with a little bit of a light story, shall we? This is from, well, we found it from multiple sources, but I quite liked Mashable's coverage of it. If you think that monks can't be adorable or furry, well, you're wrong. I don't know how many people actually don't think that monks can be furry. But anyway, we present to you Carmelo, the newest, cutest monk of the Franciscan monastery of Cochabamba. Yeah, let's go with that. Cochabamba, Bolivia. Carmelo, a stray schnauzer, that's a dog, adopted by the monastery, has quickly become a member of the family and even wears his own habit to look the part. Facebook user Casper Maurice Capron. Yep, there we go. Who we're pretty sure his last name is not Offham, that he is
Franciscan.
He's a Franciscan monk. Posted photos of the fluffy friar hanging out at his new home with his new friends. We'll put the link in the show notes so you can have a look at these cute photos. According to fellow friar Jorge Fernandez, Camelo's new life consists of running and playing, and he couldn't be happier. All of the brothers in the monastery love him very much. Carmelo has also been given a formal name, Friar Bigoton. Which fittingly translates to friar mustache.
Okay. And not bigoted friar.
No, not so much. Per Catholic tradition, St. Francis of Assisi is the patron saint of animals, so it's only right this little pup became the monastery's mascot. He's even spreading the love to other animals in his new home. His adoption became possible by a local animal rescue group. The group wrote on Facebook, because I'm not even trying to... It's the Cold Nose Project, is the name of the book. If all the churches... Well, come on, man. Proyecto Narices Frias. If all the churches in our country take just a puppy and I take care of and take care as Friar Bigotone, we are sure that the parishioners would follow her example. Well, there you go. And I... you can have a dog as a friar. I mean, I do think it's very cute. And we've struggled of recent to come up with really light stories. So much heavy stuff we thought would end with that. What do you reckon? Do you reckon churches around the country, Anna, are going to take to this idea and adopt a pet as their local mascot?
Well, I mean, there's often cats wandering around churches, true, or wandering in churches in the middle of mass or something like
that's
that.
That's true.
When do you get a mass?
What's that?
When do you get
cats wandering in?
It's happened a few times. But, yeah, look, I think it's a lovely story, isn't it? And he's a wee cutie.
Yes. Very cute.
And, yeah. Is the story you found because you found this yourself? Is it the one with pictures of the dog looking like he's talking to the fish?
Yes.
Is that one of the pictures?
Yeah.
So yeah, they're talking about how he's preaching to the fish. To me, it looks like he's looking for a feed. But
yeah, I was thinking your talking was not quite right, given.
Yeah, that was a very generous interpretation, saying he was preaching to the fish.
Yeah,
he was actually looking for some dinner.
No, I think it's good. Although I don't know if they like the idea of animals wandering into churches in Australia, Gavin, given that most of the animals over there can kill you by looking at you.
Yeah, just be careful for them. I'll be on the lookout this Sunday. So.
Yep, just keep an eye out. Well, if you'd like to keep an eye out for some of the historical episodes of the 15th Station, you can do that on our website, www.station15.co.nz. Or you can find us in iTunes or the Google Play Store if you just search for the 15th Station. If you want to reach out to us, we've been getting some great feedback from listeners lately. Thank you very much for those that have been sending us notes. Always loved hearing from our listeners from around the world. And you can do the same to sending us feedback at station15.co.nz. Sorry, podcast at station15.co.nz. They both work. But podcast at station15.co.nz. If you want to talk to us on the Twitters, twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. I think that's all of them. If I forgot anything, Gavin, it's not like this is my first rodeo. I should really have a script by now.
I think it's your 113th rodeo, isn't it?
It's about that. I think
because you missed one.
I did miss one.
But you missed two.
No, one. Well, maybe it was. Yeah. I don't know. Okay. But thank you very much, Anna. It's been lovely to have you on the podcast. We hope you'll come back again.
Oh, you're welcome, and I'll have a think about it.
Wow.
No, that's fine. I was just putting you
on
the spot.
Maybe we should run a Twitter poll and say, do you want Don back or do you want Anna back?
No, we can have both. We've had more than a couple of people on this podcast at any one time. And thank you very much, Gavin. We wouldn't have a podcast without you, as I say, each month, but it's true.
Well, it is true, and you'd have better light stories if I wasn't doing it. So swings and roundabouts, I'd call it. Thank you, James.
That's all right, no problem. Thank you all for listening. We hope that we're starting to get to the change of the seasons here in New Zealand, so I'm assuming that's the same on the rest of the globe. So whether you're warming up or, in our case, starting to cool down, we hope that you're in a great place. And until we talk to you next time, next month, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.